Welcome to Inspiring Futures. I'm your host, Ed Cotton. This is a podcast where we talk about the how, what, and why of the future. Welcome to the latest episode of Inspiring Futures. My guest today is Vasant Seshadri of Sunnyside in Singapore. You are the creative director and founder, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, founder and creative director of the Sunnyside. Yeah.
So welcome to Inspiring Futures. What time is it in Singapore now? It's like in the evening?
It's 7 p.m. in the evening. It's exactly 12 hours out of sync from New York.
Yeah. So 7 o'clock for me, 7 p.m. for you. Let's start. Take us through a little bit of your background, how you got into the advertising business, where you started, where you studied, a little bit of that.
Hi, I'm Vasant. I run an independent creative agency in Singapore called the Sunnyside. And I actually started out as a software engineer. Like, I studied computer engineering, and my very first job in Singapore was as a software engineer, because that's kind of like the point of parity. It's the thing you do in before you figure out what you want, actually want to do. Like, if you grow up in Asia, like, you've got to be an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer. It's one of those cultural things. So normally a lot of us study one of those things, and then we figure out what we actually want to do with our lives. And when I was a software engineer, I felt there should be something a little bit more like exciting than this. Like, maybe there is a different kind of person who gets excited by software engineering, but I'm not. And a good thing was that digital marketing was starting up, and that was 2009, like 13 years ago. And so there was an increasing demand of people who understand like digital technology in advertising. So my very first job was at a digital agency, Wunderman, before it became Wunderman Thompson. And that was in Singapore. And after a couple of years there, I had the opportunity to work in BBDO New York. And that was an opportunity I couldn't pass up, because it is one of the hallowed grounds of the advertising industry. Like, it's one of those places where nearly everyone you see around you is an exceptional talent. And there are probably like fewer than 10 such agencies in the world. Like, Wieden & Kennedy could be another, Drogo 5 could be another, and BBDO New York is really in that league. So I jumped at the chance to spend a couple of years there. And that was my education in advertising. Like, I never went to ad school, but I went to BBDO New York, which is probably a better education. And like, I mean, some of the best talents like ever in advertising have passed through the doors of BBDO New York. And a couple of them have actually been on this podcast. Like, I listened to the episode with Greg Hahn, who I knew during my time there. And I also knew Mo Syed during my time there. So, and both those guys have been on this podcast. And after a couple of years there, I came back to Singapore and I worked for a few agencies like JWT and Edelman and then Sapient. But about 4 years ago in 2018, I started my own agency, the Sunnyside. And we operate in a very nimble and agile way, where we have a very lean core team, but we have an ecosystem of freelancers that we tap into as and when their particular skills suit a particular project. But we're not like Fiverr or Upwork, though, where there are literally like thousands of freelancers. Like, we work with a team of like maybe 20 to 25 freelancers that we keep going back to, and many of them are people I have worked with in the past, and I knew that they are good at what they do before I brought them into this network. For each particular project, there could be, it could be a lean team of like just four or five people. Like, and we've done a variety of work. We've done everything from 100% digital to 100% traditional advertising to everywhere else in between. And that means that we shapeshift, and we have a different combination of talents for each project. And also, we're not constrained by geography. Like, we've worked with like people in South Africa. We've worked with people in Ukraine, and we're trying to give them more projects now. We worked with people in the Philippines and India and like many other places. And likewise, the clients we have are also all over the world. Like we have clients in Germany, we have clients in Switzerland, and quite a few like multinationals as well as SMEs have been interested in us. Like we have among our clients like P&G and Novartis and Sephora. We are a qualified agency for those brands. And we also have like health tech SMEs and food tech SMEs that we've worked with.
That's really interesting. Thanks for taking us through that. So I also recognize that you're an author. You've written a couple of books, so we can talk about that later as well. You didn't mention that you were a writer.
Yeah, we could talk about it now, actually. Like, I've written a couple of books, and the first one is Cultural Engineering, which is about the role of brands in a changing world and the roles and responsibilities that brands have in wading into culture and catalyzing changes in it. So in that, I talk about like things like the Dove campaign for Real Beauty and Like a Girl by Always, where those are brands that identified that their consumers have some like self-esteem issues that they can engineer, they can re-engineer, they can help them dismantle those self-esteem issues. And like Dove campaign for Real Beauty has been doing it for almost two decades now. And I also talk about brands like Burger King when they did Proud Whopper, which started a conversation about like attitudes towards the LGBTQ plus community. And also like I talk about a lot of things that have happened in Asia, like how Lifebuoy, the Unilever brand, has literally taught 1 billion people safe hand washing habits, and about how such work has gone way beyond what we typically expected from advertising in the past. And though I wrote it a couple of years ago, it has actually become more relevant in the last 2 years because the expectation on brands to take a stand on issues has only increased. Like if you look at the recent Roe v. Wade issue, like you have Ad Age doing a tracker of the brands that have taken a stand on this issue. And there's this an expectation that you can't just be selling your product anymore, that you have to support the people who support you. And so it has only become more relevant in the last 2 years. And last year, it reached a worldwide number 11 position in the bestsellers list in the media and communications category. That's the highest it reached. And of course, it would have been better to get in the top 10, but yeah, it's still pretty good, I think. And the second book I wrote was just a few months ago, and it's actually a novel called The People from Beyond the Mountains. And it is a novel with a climate change message. Like if I talk too much about it, it'll be a spoiler, but it's about like two groups of people who initially start off having mistrust for each other, but then they realize that they have a mutual existential risk, mutual existential threats, and then that brings them together. So it talks about not only climate change, but also xenophobia and how we need to dismantle xenophobia in order to face our mutual existential threats.
Very, 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 very interesting. When you were a software engineer, did you imagine that you'd also be an author? Did you know that would be something you'd do, or have you surprised yourself?
I surprised myself. Yeah. I mean, when I was a software engineer, I did believe that maybe I would do something more creative. Like I had a thought of maybe getting into filmmaking, and I had some top level ideas in mind, and maybe I'll still do that one day. But I wasn't too serious about it. Like I was, I probably wouldn't have believed it if someone told me that I'd be an author in like 13 years after that.
So two very, you know, obviously there's a similarity, there's the red thread between the two books, but one is you're writing fiction, and the other is you're relying a lot on facts and what people have done, and that seems quite like a different part of the brain almost to imagine this scenario where yes, this message is climate change, but there is a sort of a fictional, you've got to create these fictional worlds. It's quite a interesting challenge, right?
Yep. So in a way, I mean, though one is fiction, the other is nonfiction, one might have led to the other. Like when I wrote cultural engineering, I talked about like brands like REI and Patagonia and what they've done for the environment, and how REI shut their stores on Black Friday and they've been doing that every year since, and stuff like how they re-engineered their supply chain to embrace the circular economy. So a lot of things I wrote in cultural engineering kind of inspired me to pick that topic.
Yeah, so it makes sense. Yeah, totally. Mm. You know, we're going through something of a purpose backlash right now. You know, it seems that there's quite a lot of frustration, that especially as we came from the Cannes Awards show, where a lot of purpose initiatives won awards. And I think people are wondering, you know, how genuine these efforts are, who they're really trying to talk to, and if these efforts are actually responsible for growth. And I think Mark Pritchard said something at Cannes about it's growth first and purpose second. Are you aware of these of this sort of backlash that's happening?
Yep, absolutely. And I think it's because a lot of like purpose-driven pieces of work have become chasing the shiny new object, and rather than actually making it aligned with your brand's values. Like, I mean, you've got to look at the fit between your brand and the cause you're espousing. Like, I know we talked about Patagonia, and Patagonia is talked about a lot, but it was founded by an actual environmentalist. So when they fight for the environment, when they talk about like protecting national parks, and that is authentic. That completely makes sense. So, but when brands do it, when there's absolutely no fit, like you might remember a pretty infamous like Pepsi commercial with Kendall Jenner a few years ago. And first of all, in that commercial, I mean, if you can call it a commercial, in that film, it wasn't very clear what the cause was and what the connection with Pepsi was. Like, a lot of people said things like, oh, I just have to give a Pepsi to a person and all their worries and all the things that are bothering them will go away. I didn't know it was that easy, that kind of a thing. And so I think it's a case of looking at the fit and also about walking the walk. Like, walking the walk is increasingly becoming something people observe and people point out in case a business is not walking the walk. Like, I mean, for the past couple of years, I mean, there's been a reckoning and an awakening regarding like racial justice, and like businesses have stepped into the issue. And Unilever was one of the brands that, one of the marketers that were quite vocal about it in 2020. Of course, 2020 was when the awakening happened with the murder of George Floyd, and like many businesses started expressing themselves on that, and Unilever was one of them. But what happened when Unilever did that was that a group of their consumers identified that, hey, you're saying verbally that you support the African American community, but in India you have this product called Fair and Lovely, which is literally cream that lightens your skin, and they've been like marketing it in India since the 70s. And the whole crux of it was that to make Indian women like feel inadequate about their dark skin and try to lighten their skin. And so a lot of people pointed out, like, why do you have a brand like this? And then you say that you're supporting supporting people of all races and all colors. So what Unilever had to do immediately was they renamed, to their credit, they responded to that. They didn't ignore it. Within a couple of months, they renamed Fair and Lovely to Glow and Lovely, which is grammatically questionable, but morally and ethically much better. And they said, we're not going to promote light skin as an ideal, and we're going to talk about a glowing, supple, healthy skin instead. So a handful of their consumers pointing out a hypocrisy was enough for them to respond quickly and change the name of a product that has been there for the last 40, 50 years, and also change the entire marketing approach for it. So there's an expectation for businesses and brands to do this kind of walking the walk. So if you're willing to do that, if you're willing to respond, change with the times and walk the walk and take actions that are consistent with your communication, then you stand to gain a lot of like kudos for it. It's when you don't do that and when you just pick a cause because that seems to be cool and seems to be the in thing, that's when the purpose backlash kind of happens.
I think the other thing is that for me, the problem is that we're an industry that's very reductive. We're in the business to simplify. And unfortunately, these causes and issues are incredibly complex and they can't necessarily be simplified. And they certainly can't be one-offs. I mean, if you want to make the changes that you're suggesting, these need to be committed long-term efforts. And sometimes they seem to be gratuitous short-term efforts to win awards, and their actual impact won't be felt because they're not long-term enough. And the problem with advertising is an industry that gets bored of doing things very, very quickly. And, you know, campaigns end way before they should end, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's some interesting points. And we're at a really very, very important point in the whole of this purpose debate, because what we're starting to see now is inflation, costs of living, impact the consumer on their spending, and the purpose focus and the premium focus of some of the purpose brands is coming under a lot of pressure. I think it'll be interesting to see where that goes in the future. Well, let's switch back and talk a little bit about starting your own business. Was that an obvious thing you wanted to do? You know, you come back to Singapore, that you'd worked at a few agencies. Was that always in your mind that you were going to start your own?
That was like slowly. I mean, that started out as a little voice in the back of my head, and then over the years it became louder and louder. And it got to a point where it felt like a good time to do it. Like I was coming close to a decade in advertising, and I had enough knowledge as well as enough of a network of like creatives and strategists and suits I knew, and to the point where I felt it was the right time to take the plunge. And if I'd waited longer, it felt like I would probably lose that hunger, like if I waited another 5 years. But so it just felt like the right time around 2018.
So 2018, so you've been at it for 4 years. What's the biggest learning you had from being an employee to being an employer?
The biggest shift in mindset that I had to get used to was that the buck stops with me. And when you're working for someone else, there'll be a CD, an ECD, a CCO, a planner, a suit, and like so many people who can catch something if it's odd or if it's not going to work. Whereas when I'm the creative director and also the founder, like every single piece of work that gets out of the door of this agency is something I'm responsible for. And I had to quickly get used to the fact that we're only as good as our weakest work. And there is nowhere to hide if something substandard sneaks in out of the door. Like the buck stops with me. That was the biggest learning that I had to quickly adapt to. And of course, for somebody who started as a creative, suddenly getting used to managing the finances of an agency, managing even sometimes being my own planner on stuff, that was quite an interesting challenge. And it was a little scary because I was out of my comfort zone. But then, I mean, out of people's comfort zone is when they grow. Like when people get out of their comfort zone, is that's when they grow. So I quickly kind of adapted to a new way of approaching things.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely sounds like a, you know, an interesting challenge. I wondered as well how, you know, business development seems another important thing when it comes to running your own, you know, in a big agency, you've got people doing business development, you wait for the business to come in, you just sit there. Maybe you do pitches. How have you managed the business development side of your business?
So far, I've been doing a lot of it myself, and that's another thing I've had to adapt to. Yeah. And so far, just like the creatives I work with are like people I've worked with in the past, and I trust them. Even the clients, like a lot of them, so far have been like people who have worked with me in the past and know that I can deliver for them. And so that's how it has been mostly. But that's how the first few clients that we got came about. But now, I mean, now that we have credibility in certain spaces like healthcare and food, now even people who completely don't know any of us are like willing to talk to us since we have a body of work in this space. Yeah.
So your work becomes your calling card, and you get calls. So, you know, one of the things you started talking about was agility. So do you feel that's a competitive advantage for you? Obviously over the network agencies, but maybe even over some of the more independent agencies in Singapore or globally?
It's definitely an advantage over network agencies. Done integrated campaigns at network agencies, which took 9 months from inception till execution. Whereas I've done similar sized campaigns that took just 4 months, like after starting my own independent agency. So things do move quicker at an independent agency. Whether it is an advantage over other independent agencies, I wouldn't know because I actually haven't worked for other independent agencies. But I think it depends on the size. Like, I mean, if an independent agency becomes bigger and bigger, there are more layers and more silos, then they start becoming like a network agency, even though they are independent. So I think there is a certain like size beyond which an independent agency becomes like a network agency. I don't know exactly what that size is, but there is some point where it becomes like that.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, yeah, it just depends on the size of the account and how many, usually how many decision makers there are and how much budget is being spent, because you end up, you know, suddenly things have to be redone or things have to be tested in research, or there's a kind of whole protocol. But you've already said you work with some big, some big brands.
Yep. And there is more of a thirst now by big brands as well as mid-sized ones. There's more of a thirst to explore different ways of working.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Procter & Gamble. Did you get into the small agency program that they have? Is that because they had only been working with network agencies for a long time, but I know in the last 5 or so years, they've been looking for smaller agencies.
Yep, I mean, I followed that. We didn't go through their small agency program. Mm-hmm. What happened was when I was at BBDO New York, I was in the Gillette team there. And Gillette is part of Procter & Gamble. And some of, like I had built some credibility with P&G as well as with some of the individuals who were in the Gillette team at the time. And And they were kind enough to connect me with others within their organization so it was pretty much like that. But that can only get us the audience. Like that can never guarantee a project. Like we still had to go and wowed them with our strategic and creative thinking and to get a few projects from them. And quite often we've gone up against big network agencies, including the agency of record of some brands, and we've prized away some projects from them.
Yeah, so it's very interesting because I think, you know, that's why, you know, we've got a confluence of different factors making it so much easier to be a global agency, right? You don't need to have the offices. Clients are a lot more flexible than they ever were. I remember P&G saying at one point before they started their small agency initiative, it was like, it costs us $1 million, you know, to train an agency, you know, and we're not going to spend that money on people we're not going to have long-term relationships with. So, you know, we've seen, you know, clients being open to working on small projects with a different array of talent, which we didn't see 50 years ago. So that's played into your hands too.
Yep. And probably the post-pandemic landscape has also made the clients experiment a bit more, because now they know that like even if they are in a certain city and the agency is in a certain city, they have to get used to working remotely with them, with people in the same city. Like I have people in Singapore with whom I work only remotely. So that kind of made a lot of people like realize that geography probably doesn't matter so much anymore.
Yeah, I think that's huge. Yeah, it changed that, you know, the idea that you have to be in their office or they have to come to your office is, you know, that's made a really important point. Let's talk a little bit about, how much work do you actually do in Asia? How much of the work you do is, I know you're based in Singapore, but how much of the work you produce is running in Asia?
Because Singapore is a pretty tiny country, there are only like 5 million of us. A lot of the advertising that is produced in Singapore is produced for other Asian markets. Like there's work that's produced for India, for Japan, for Philippines, for Indonesia, for Vietnam, that is produced out of Singapore. And that makes it quite a dynamic industry here, because that also means that talent from those countries comes to Singapore, because it's hard to have a fully Singaporean team understanding India or understanding Vietnam. So that has led to a bit of a melting pot, like in a sense that Singapore is a bit of the New York of Asia, if that makes sense. So like I've personally done work that has launched in Taiwan, in Japan, in Philippines, in Australia, even for a bit. And that's one of the good things about working in Singapore. In fact, it was kind of like that when I was in New York as well. Like I was part of the Gillette team that was producing work for North America, South America, and Europe. So it's good that in these kinds of hubs, like a New York or a London or a Singapore or Dubai, you get to produce work for not just your country, but also quite a few countries in the region.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Obviously the geography, Singapore's geography makes a lot of sense. It's in a really great place, but those cultures are very, very different. You know, the Japanese culture is extremely different from the Indian culture. What do you find? I think it's kind of like, there's always a battle, right? I mean, between people wanting to sort of commodify and, you know, homogenize cultures.
Yep.
And what do you find out in Asia? Because those cultures, although Asian cultures, they are very different. Do you find a lot of battles for the local markets to be reflected in their advertising?
Yep, there is a constant battle in Asia, because you'll have the team in India that says like we have like so much talent at home that understands this market intimately, like why do we need the regional office in Singapore to do it for us? Like we'll have like the team in Philippines would say the same thing, and of course everyone is territorial. The team in Singapore will try to hold as much of it as possible. I think, yeah, that is a constant battle. And I'm in two minds about it, actually, because on the one hand, there is this argument that you need to really like have the intimate knowledge of that particular culture and grow up there in order to get under the skin of the people and do something that appeals to them. There's also this school of thought that like human nature doesn't change when you cross a national boundary, that you can, if you find a human insight that can work in many different countries. And of course, another issue is also the talent you see in an ad. Like there's a huge demand for like Pan-Asian talent. And Pan-Asian talent is also the most expensive talent, because if you pick a couple of Pan-Asian talents, you can run the same ad in Japan and Indonesia and Vietnam and China. And I've also heard that South America, the Middle East, and India often uses the same talent as well.
Very interesting. So
it's a tug of war that's going on, and it's a bit hard to tell where it's going to land, whether it's going to land in this centralize and universalize everything or go super local on everything. I think there's a constant tension, and it's not clear where it's going to land eventually.
Yeah, I think so much of that has to do with budgets, how much the client has to spend on production in particular and agency fees. And if they have limited budget, they want to be as efficient as possible. But I always look to India, to me, as one of the most interesting markets for strategy, because there's so much change going on in that country. Some of the best advertising, I think, has been reflective of that change, especially when it comes to women and changing role of women in society. And I think that's hard to replicate. You know, that's an India thing. Maybe it's other cultures, but I remember the work that was done a long time ago for diamonds in India that was really culturally changing, because gold was the predominant gem or material for weddings. And the diamonds, I think it was De Beers, looked at a new generation of women in India who had new values, and they attuned themselves into those values. I think it's it's always a challenge to get that right. What other things would you say characterize the Asian advertising agency scene that are different from what you might find in North America?
I think in Asia, agencies tend to hire from a wider range of backgrounds. Like I'm a software engineer, and I'm not the only engineer I know who got into advertising. I can think of at least five from the top of my mind. And I also know someone who studied biotech and then got into advertising. And there are people have studied a wide range of different things and then have gotten to advertising. And there isn't much of a prestige associated with portfolio schools in Asia. I only heard of the most famous portfolio schools, like Miami Ad School and VCU Brand Center, after I started working in New York. And it has good and bad things. One good thing about portfolio schools is that it really trains you well, even before you do your first job. So there is that. But on the other hand, sometimes I feel that maybe it trains too many people in exactly the same way. And maybe you need suddenly you need someone who started out as, let's say, studied mathematics or something, or somebody who studied law and then gets into advertising. Maybe you do have more of that happening in Asia, I think.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think the diversity of talent probably makes for more interesting work. So there are no other creative schools emerging in Asia, or you still don't have them? You're starting to see them?
Yeah, but in fact, Miami Ad School itself, it's a friend of mine who is opening Miami Ad Schools in India, and similarly, there are people who are looking to like open up those same famous schools in this part of the world, but there isn't really that much of a hunger for it among the upcoming talent, I think. I think there's probably a tendency that, I mean, for each person to think they know best, and it's more, and I think it's happening in Europe as well. Like Berg's in Sweden is an excellent portfolio school. I think North America and Europe are where the prestige associated with portfolio schools has become big, and it's not really happening in Asia, I think.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. You mentioned earlier that you were building expertise in food, and I didn't understand whether it was a certain area of food or.
Like we've done like a few projects for like one of Singapore's like most well-known food tech startups, and we're also like talking to a few clients in the alternative meat, like plant-based and cell-based meat space. And we've done a small project for a bigger restaurant as well.
Yeah.
So that's something we're trying to get more into. And we have a lot more credibility in health at the moment. Like in the last couple of years, in fact, a disproportionate number of our projects have been from healthcare clients.
Like, is that pharmaceuticals? Is that what type of...
Well, we're a qualified agency for one major pharmaceutical, which is Novartis, and the rest have been more like mid-sized players. Like we have a health tech SME in Germany, who is one of our clients at the moment, and we have a hospital chain in Singapore that's another of our clients. So that's part of what I meant, that once we gain a certain amount of credibility and a certain body of work in a certain space, like even people who don't know us are interested in talking to us.
Yeah, because word spreads. So how do you describe the startup scene in Singapore? Is it a healthy, thriving scene? Is it how would you describe what's happening?
Yep, it is a thriving scene, like not necessarily in terms of startup advertising agencies, but in terms of startups in general. Like it's a big hub for like plant-based and cell-based meat startups. It's a big hub for fintech startups and for a lot of the stuff that's and health startups as well. A lot of the stuff that the world is looking at as engines for growth, Singapore is quite front and center in positioning itself as a hub for those. Like it's also becoming a climate tech startup, and also like there are some like electric vehicles and startups that have sprouted up in Singapore, and it's actually one of the more attractive places for a startup to start. Like you have entrepreneurs from all over the world who get attracted to the startup scene here.
Is that because the government is actively involved?
Yeah, the government is actively involved. The government is actively involved in like reducing the barriers to starting a new business here, and also, I mean, by being a safe and English speaking and kind of a country, that kind of makes it easier for like people from all over the world. Like there's an expression that Singapore is Asia for beginners.
Mm-hmm. So it's a place where you learn to swim and things are made easy for you versus a complicated market like India, which would be hard. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. You have countries like India and Philippines and Indonesia and Vietnam and China, which are all really complex countries, and especially really complex if you're not from there. But Singapore is kind of a place that makes it easy to integrate, like wherever you're from.
So do we still have, I mean, what, I know BBH had an office in Singapore. Do they still have an office there?
Yeah, they do. And they are one of the better agencies here at the moment.
So how would you describe, because I always see Singapore work. I mean, I haven't seen all of it, but I know it can have a high level of creativity. Is that still the case? The local advertising. I know you're talking about a small market, but I remember, you know, some campaigns in the past have been really good.
Yeah, there's still a lot of like can winning work coming out of Singapore, and but a lot of it is not necessarily for Singapore. Like Publicis Singapore does a lot of work for India, for P&G brands, and a lot of it wins at Cannes. Like they did this film recently, like Publicis Singapore done this film for Vicks in India recently that showed this doctor who was helping patients during COVID, and unfortunately the doctor contracted COVID and didn't make it. Yeah. And so that won something in Cannes this year. And earlier they've done other work for Vicks, like the first Touch of Care film that, you know, there's this, you might've seen this film that won a lot in Cannes, where there's this like girl in India in a kind of low income kind of neighborhood where she talks about how her mom is like working hard and saving up so that she can get a good education and all those kinds of things. And then like, it's a pretty long film, like 5 minutes. And about 3.5 minutes into the film, you realize that her mom is a transgender woman. Mm-hmm. And she's doing all that while she's also overcoming the bias that mm-hmm. a transgender woman faces. So that kind of changes the whole film. And that was very widely appreciated and it won a bunch of Cannes Lions. Mm-hmm. And that was, even though it was a film for India, that was done out of Publicis Singapore. So Singapore agencies do continue to win Cannes Lions, but it's not usually for the Singapore market because the Singapore market is pretty tiny.
Yeah. So what are your goals for the future of your agency? How do you see the next 5 years, 3 years panning out for you? What are you hoping for?
We definitely want to grow in the sense that to have a few more like retainers and that'll justify like expanding, like having a bigger team, and also like maybe if we get to the stage where we have enough of a stream of projects in a particular market, we might even expand to the market and open an office there. But I think there should also be a limit to how much we grow, because if we grow to the point where we are become like a network agency, we will start making some of the same mistakes. So I do have a little bit of a dilemma regarding exactly how large I want it to grow, but I think that would be a good problem to have when we get there. I think at the moment, growth is definitely, growth in terms of getting as many clients as possible is the focus.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. There's a nice manageable number of people that you want to have that allows you to still to be agile and nimble, but not falling into the do you feel that there's nothing holding you back from getting clients? Is it just about personal relationships? Do you feel that the best opportunities are pan-Asian or within the specific markets themselves?
The best opportunities are in specific markets, but like India could be one, like Vietnam, we've already done work for Vietnam, Indonesia could be another, but China is kind of like self-contained and it's like a whole, a big whole world in itself, like, and they don't really look at, say, Singapore to manage their work. Like we can manage it ourselves. That's the kind of thinking. And so it's China's kind of a little bit of a hard to crack. But other than that, we are kind of well qualified to do work for most Asian markets. So I think growth is going to be in most of the Asian markets, and rather than Singapore. And we are open to doing like work even for North American clients for that matter. But then North America is like very saturated. There's like literally thousands of agencies everywhere. Like you don't, like, so those are markets that don't really have to look at a Singapore agency to do work for them. So I think most of the opportunities are in Asia. Yeah. Mm.
Talk a little bit, you mentioned earlier about working with people in Ukraine. Is that something that you're still doing? Is that something that you've, how did you make that happen?
It was actually like a couple of years ago, before anyone knew that the situation in Ukraine now would be what it is.
Yeah.
Like it so happens that there are a lot of like good developers in Eastern Europe, Ukraine and Romania and places like that. So like I, as part of my efforts to expand the network of talents we work with, I got in touch with some like technical studios in Ukraine. And so I've tried to give them more projects now, but that actually depends on how many of the projects I get are digital in nature, because if I get more like film production projects, if I get more just like graphic design kind of projects, like it's not really something that a digital like development studio would need. And for some reason, like most of the people in Ukraine I've come across, I've personally come across, are the more technical people rather than the more say graphic design kinds of people. So it depends on having the right opportunity to bring them in. Like given a chance, I would actually like to support more of them. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, there is a big, group population who are working in ad agencies or design studios who are still looking for work, not just the technical people. And I know one agency out there in Kiev that is working. They're working with people in Brazil, and they're doing a lot of like banner design and things like that. But it's been very, very hard to get people in America to really think about the idea of working with people in Ukraine.
That's definitely something I'm open to doing.
Yeah. Well, I might send you the details of this agency. You might want to get in touch with them.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did, another question I had is, what does it take to become one of the top 15 selling book in the category of marketing? Is that digital wizardry? Is it having good PR? How did you manage?
What I tried to do was that when I wrote the book, I didn't just write it as a kind of collection of case studies. Like I didn't do it like that, because you can get that from YouTube. What I tried to do was I tried to delineate a methodology for how to go about engineering culture. Like I talked about a three-step process, which is identifying societal tension, addressing it with a creative solution, and following through with actions. And within each of those three, I kind of dived deep into how to go about identifying a societal tension and validating it with informal and formal research, and then the creative process, and then what are the things you do to follow through on it. So I tried to make it like a textbook rather than just a collection of observations. I tried to actually
I
tried to make it something that people could look at and learn from if you're just starting out in the industry, for instance. So I think the content kind of sold itself, because I don't have a super elaborate PR team or anything. In fact, I don't have anyone who kind of PR'd the shit out of the book. Like I didn't have that, but I think word of mouth just helped. Of course, I sent the link to all the people people I know in advertising, and did the usual stuff like just putting it on all my socials, but nothing beyond that from a PR blitz standpoint. So I just tried to make the content as useful as possible.
Yeah, that's the secret, isn't it? Having something people can understand. Are you very active on LinkedIn, for example? Is that something that you basically spend a lot of time, or not so much?
Yeah, it is actually. Like I do spend a lot of time there, and partly to connect with new people that I could possibly work with, but also partly to kind of express stuff I want to express. I was recently like talking about like my opinions on some of the Cannes pieces, and also like I've been reading up a lot about Web3 and NFTs and stuff like that. So when I have like new learnings and new observations, like LinkedIn is the place I kind of share it, like more than any other social media. Like I don't tweet much. I'm not that active on Facebook. I'm not that active on Instagram, but actually LinkedIn, I would say, is probably the social network where I'm most active.
Yeah. Do you find you can connect with clients, potential clients through LinkedIn, or is it people, I think, are finding it very much, much harder?
I think it's not as easy to find new clients on LinkedIn as a lot of people think, because there's just so much spam out there. I mean, so many people cold calling. I hardly ever respond to any of the cold calls I get. Like, it's only occasionally when it turns out that somebody is from a company that has a really unique skill which can be useful to me. That's when I respond. So I do cold call on LinkedIn, but I wonder how many people who receive my cold calls react to it exactly the same way that I react to the cold calls I receive. It could be a lot. Yeah,
I think so. Mm-hmm. So what? Just switching to the NFTs for a second. What's your take on NFTs? Is that something you think is an interesting space for brands? Or, I mean, it's a big area. What's your learning been so far?
I think it is at the stage where social media was 15 years ago.
Yeah.
When if you look at around 2006, 2007, when Friendster and MySpace were the biggest social networks, everyone was kind of tentatively looking at whether to wade into it. And there was a lot of thought about, do we really need a social media strategy? But now it goes without saying that you need a social media strategy. And similarly, I think NFTs and even Web3 and the metaverse in general are something that a lot of people are just tentatively looking at and seeing, do we need to do it or not? And I think it'll probably take another 10 to 15 years for it to become as mainstream as social media is today. And just like Friendster and MySpace are obsolete now, the metaverse platforms that are there now may not be the ones that actually take us to fulfilling the potential of the metaverse. It could be someone else entirely. Like MySpace and Friendster couldn't do it, but Facebook and Twitter could. So similarly, the names you hear today in the metaverse space may not necessarily be the ones who actually make it big. But I think it will happen in the same way that social media kind of slowly became mainstream. I think NFTs in the metaverse are also at the start of that and will get there.
Yeah. I mean, is it in your recommendation, is it something that clients should be experimenting with, or is it too early?
I think I know it's a bit of a sitting on the fence answer, but I think it depends on the brand.
Sure.
You have brands like Nike and Adidas who are more adventurous into it because they have a more adventurous kind of a consumer.
Yep.
And somebody who would be excited if Nike or Adidas goes and mints a bunch of NFTs, and somebody would actually go and buy it and sell it in the secondary market and stuff. Also last year, SK2 did something called SK2 City, which is a completely immersive virtual city. So, I mean, in the metaverse, you have the NFTs, but you also have this completely immersive virtual worlds where NFTs play a part, but they're part of the world building and part of the gamification, but the immersive experience is the one. And you have a brand like SK2 getting into it, and fashion brands and even skincare and haircare brands kind of are getting into it a bit more. Vogue minted a bunch of NFTs. So I think these kinds of brands have a consumer base that will be excited by this. And I think these are the ones who stand to gain immediately by getting into the space. But if you're not one of those, if you don't have much of an exciting reason to do it right now, and you want to do it because of the shiny new object syndrome, then that's probably not a good idea. Probably you'll have to wait for the right use case, the right kind of way to say gamify a bunch of NFTs, for instance, before you jump in. I think it's, if you're an individual and you just want to play around in that space and mint a couple of NFTs to just, again, understanding, that's fine. But if you're a brand, I think you need to find the right use case for it.
Cool. Just finally, to what has been in what is in the last couple of months inspiring you? Is it something you see or it can? Is it a book you read? What has got your brain firing and excited you've seen?
I think in a way I may have already answered the question because I'm reading up a lot about the metaverse and about NFTs at the moment, but I'm also looking at I've also been reading like leadership books in general. Like there's this excellent book I read called CEO Excellence. Not sure if you came across that. And it's on LinkedIn, in fact, because a lot of people, I mean, that's one of the advantages of spending a lot of time on LinkedIn is that you kind of know about what are the good books out there. And this book, I mean, there are plenty of management books, but this book kind of has done a lot of research. It's by three people from McKinsey, and they've done a lot of research into what makes the best CEOs do what they do well. And there's a lot of like really good like insights in it. So I'm also trying to, like in addition to the creative field, I'm also trying to learn more about the managerial side of things.
So, yeah, that sounds great. Well, it's been really fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much. Very, very interesting. I'll let you know. When I post this up live, and you can spread the word.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, sounds awesome. Yeah, thanks a lot for doing it like early in the morning. I'm not sure maybe you're on a meeting either, but
I'm now awake. Thank you very much. All right.
Yep, thanks a lot.
This is your host, Ed Colton. Thank you so much for listening to Inspiring Futures. Until next time.